Game on, boyfriend.
Are you about to dispute my official ruling in the sacred tradition of nose goes?
Technically correct.
I should have known. She didn't like me. I don't think anybody likes you.
I like me.
With Tyler Bischoff.
Okay, the zone's not working. They're a little bit too good to cover man to man. And we can't shoot for shit.
On ESPN Las Vegas.
Hello, Texas State might beat UNLV. There's only one way that this show can properly cover Marc-Andre Fleury's diving save last night, and that is giving you the equally entertaining call of Jesus Lopez and Herbert Castro from our sister station on ESPN Deportes.
Bien, Stone, para Shea Theodore. Hay que retenerlo, hay que meterlo adelante, Nicholas Haig, eso es lo que no hay que hacer. Faltó mandarlo más lejos. ¡Disparo! Y pegó en el poste de Mike.
¡Daba el Castro!
¡No!
¡Esa es tu épica! ¡Mike Fleury!
¡No! Señores, como un portero de soccer, voló. Mira, lo llega y lo abraza a Teodor.
¡Qué bárbaro!
Ese es un vuelo de portero de soccer. Mira, ahí está.
Herbert Castro cannot believe it. He literally can't believe it. It's awesome. His laugh, by the way, is incredible because he does not wait for Jesus Lopez to actually call what happened. That's his spontaneous reaction of holy bleep. Oh! Like, he just had to get that out, and it is beautiful. What's also great is their reaction once they showed the replay up on the video board, because it was almost like everyone in the building saw what happened, but didn't quite comprehend what happened until they saw a replay.
Se lanza completamente. No, qué bárbaro.
Vamos a la pausa.
La agarró en el aire. En un vuelo con.
La parada del año. La parada del año.
No lo puedo.
Espérate,
Evelyn, espérate. Vamos a la pausa.
Herbert Castro still can't believe it. He's now seen the replay, still doesn't believe what he saw. And Jesus is just like a little kid that's so damn excited. Like, that's what's happening right there. Herbert Castro is in disbelief, and Jesus is like, this is the most exciting thing I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, man. That was almost better. Well, no, because that save was incredible.
So, the funny thing about goalie saves, I tend to think most of them are more bad shots than great saves. I think if we were assigning credit blame, like 75% of great saves are just poorly placed shots. Like, a shooter will have 75% of the open net to shoot at, and they'll shoot it in the 25% that the goalie's occupying. Like, what happens the most is when you have a cross ice pass and the goalie's got to go across the crease, and a guy shoots it and the goalie makes a save with his pad, right? The goal is like 90% open. All you have to do is elevate the puck about 2 feet off the ground, and you're going to score. But almost all of the great saves across the crease are guys who just, I'm going to shoot it on the ice right back towards the center of the goal. And it's like, oh, that's where the goalie gets his pad to. Like, there's certainly skill from the goalie standpoint as far as anticipation and quickness and getting across the crease. But it always feels like, to me, it's more of a failure on the shooter's part than it is a great save. That one, though, last night was not. It was a wide-open net, partially because Marc-Andre Fleury thought he got beat by the previous shot and didn't identify where the puck went after it went off the post. But once he did, it was a shot that was actually elevated. Like, that was a shot headed towards the top half of the goal, and it was also a backhanded shot, too, from a difficult angle. Like, that was an excellent shot. But Marc-Andre Fleury dove out of the air to catch it.
Like, on skates!
Yes, this wasn't like, oh, it's sliding across the ice and I just need to get my pad over there. This was, I've got to dive through the air, locate it while diving and wearing this stupid goalie mask, and catch it with my glove. It's incredible. Like, it's truly remarkable what that save was.
Would have it been in... Oh, man, I don't know. For some reason in my head, him throwing off the goalie mask to dive
like a
back.
Catcher?
Like a catcher.
Oh, foul ball. Gotta go get this one. That would have been a little dangerous. I think that's a penalty, too, if you throw your goalie mask off. But it was remarkable. By the way, so the way this game finished was an example of, like, hockey at its best. when a team is chasing a game. The Maple Leafs, they did actually tie the game for like 7 whole seconds, but the Maple Leafs were chasing that entire third period, and they were bombarding Vegas. The Maple Leafs, through the first two periods, had 33 total shot attempts. In the third period alone, had 33 total shot attempts. Scoring chances, they had 19 in the first two periods. They had 20 alone in the third period. High danger chances, 11 in the first two, 10 in the third. Like, their first two periods of hockey, well, it was okay. Like, it was a somewhat entertaining game. But that third period was terrific because the Maple Leafs knew, hey, we've got to go score, so we're just throwing everything at you. The problem for hockey is when the opposite happens. When the game is tied in the third period, the product of the sport sucks because teams don't try to win. They know if they get to overtime, they get a point. There's actually a story from 538 a while ago about this. Before the loser point was put in place, NHL games went to overtime about 18% of the time. With the loser point in place, NHL games go to overtime about 24% of the time. And the expected goals drop off about 25% per minute when the game is tied in the third period versus when it's a one-goal game. Because teams don't try to score when it's tied. They're just like, yeah, whatever. We'll take a point and try to get the second one in overtime. And that's what the NHL should probably try to fix. Because last night, the product in the third period was excellent. The way Toronto and Vegas played in the third period was as entertaining as regular season hockey can be. You don't get that Fleury diving save. If that game's tied, you do not get that diving save from Fleury. It does not happen because both teams are more content to just sit back and sort of say, okay, let's take a point and get to overtime. But because the Maple Leafs were trailing and they knew, hey, it doesn't matter if we lose in regulation by 6 or by 1, they knew they had to go for it. So the problem here is that you get rewarded for losing in overtime.
Okay, see, this is confusing to me because you, to me, seem like the kind of person that's like, if it's tied in the third period, play for overtime.
Yes, you as a team, that is a smart strategy. I'm saying the NHL needs to fix it because from an entertainment standpoint, that sucks.
Okay.
It's just like how basketball needs to go to the Elam ending where once you get to the final 5 minutes or whatever, you take the clock away and you set a target score, and the first one to reach that target score wins. Because the end of basketball games also suck a lot of the times because of fouls and timeouts.
All right.
Like, but hockey, like, you know, like last night's third period was awesome. It was only awesome because it wasn't a tie game, or for less, aside from that 7 seconds. But if that game's tied, neither team's trying as hard to win, or I should say Toronto's not trying as hard to win the game, therefore Vegas isn't getting nearly as many counterattack opportunities, and it's just not as good. It's like the game, the product is better when teams are trying to win, as it is in every single sport. The product is better when teams are trying to win. Teams are not trying very hard to win when it's tied in the third period, so they need to... I would honestly be in favor of just getting rid of the loser point. You guys have decided 3-on-3 hockey is good enough to determine who gets the extra point. Who cares about a loser point? Just play 3-on-3 hockey. You don't get a loser point. You don't get rewarded for losing in overtime. Sorry. If you don't like the other thing that would be okay would be the 3-2-1 point system where you get 3 points for a regulation win, 2 points for an overtime win, 1 point for an overtime loss. That way every game 3 points are given out instead of some having 2 and some having 3. And that way there's more incentive to go for a win in regulation because you get 3 points instead of 2. But even still, you're still rewarding a team for losing, which I hate. Like, here's the thing, the problem for the NHL. A tied game in the final 5 minutes in any sport, that should be the most exciting time to watch your sport. In hockey, it's the worst time to watch the sport.
It's literally, let's wait until overtime.
Yes, it's the worst time to watch the sport. And that's kind of what they need to fix.
All right.
Like, the point system they have is stupid. But, like, last night was great. It's the problem is you should want that. You should want that when the game's tied, too.
So then the question is, why did they implement the loser point?
Because people are hockey purists, and they're like, well, 3-on-3 is not real hockey, so we can't just penalize teams for losing when it's 3-on-3. That's ridiculous.
Okay, see, and my assumption was that it was because, well, we have to have half the teams go to the playoffs, so we need them to have a certain level of points, otherwise it's going to look ridiculous.
I mean, it still looks ridiculous.
I know.
If you just take the time to realize, oh, that third column is also losses? Why do they separate the losses from the overtime losses? Wow, that looks stupid. Yeah. No, it's the NHL's point system is ridiculously dumb. Like, soccer sometimes kind of sucks, too, because you'll have teams that play for a tie in the final minutes. It doesn't happen that often, like sometimes in Europe when there's some crappy team that's actually tied in the final 5 minutes. But then when that team ties in the final 5 minutes, that's like a win. Like, that's like their best game of the season. But at least in soccer, they did change the point system a long time ago to give you 3 points for a win instead of two. They were like, all right, let's try to incentivize this more. So if you win, you get three. If you tie, you only get one. So that's sort of like, hey, you have more reason, go win the game. So I don't know. The end of hockey games that are tied aren't all that fun.
I don't disagree.
Yeah. Last night was fun. So you want every hockey game to be a one-goal game in the final 5 minutes. Unless you get to the playoffs, then you don't get a loser point. So then it doesn't really matter as much.
I thought we wanted every game to go to a shootout. Yeah, very confused.
Well, Golden Knight, yeah, you're right. You're right. Golden Knights games we do, but that's just because of the anomaly that is Malcolm Subban does not get beat at all. That's the only thing there. Totally Correct, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Place your bets at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook all season long, every Monday night. Bourbon Street Lounge will host football viewing parties with giveaways, including jerseys. It is Technically Correct, brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com.
No puede controlar. Ahí está el robo. Tomás Nosek. La segunda canción, Nosek. Salió a Tomás Nosek, enfrentó en un face to face a Anderson, lo sacó del camino, le quebró la cintura y mandó el puck adentro, reventó la malla.
Hey, it's Tyler Bischoff. The best spot to place your bets is the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook. But if you're looking for even more convenience, download the Be Connected Sports app from BeConnectedSports.com. The Be Connected Sports app makes it easy to place bets from your phone or tablet and allows you to bet during the game. So download the Be Connected Sports app, and you can be just a few clicks away from betting on the biggest games whenever you want. Boyd Gaming has you covered at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook or at BeConnectedSports.com.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
The Southern Nevada Water Authority will delay giving the Raiders $30 million.
The Nevada Independent reporting that the Water Authority has taken the discussion for their meeting tomorrow off the agenda and pushed it back to at least January.
When things die down.
Yes. complaining worked for at least a month and a half. I assume they're going to end up giving the Raiders this contract. By the way, if you don't know what we're talking about, the Southern Nevada Water Authority is looking to sponsor the Raiders and become the official water conservation partners of the Raiders, because there's a lot of competition for that. And their proposed deal would be a 10-year deal worth $30 million. They'd give them, on average, $3 million per year to be the official water conservation partner of the Raiders. And it would give them rights to advertising in the stadium and more than likely using players or coaches for commercials like Ryan Reeves checking people, telling you to shut your water off on Sunday. I guess I should update that to shut your water off 6 of the 7 days of the week now. But I assume they're still going to give the Raiders the contract. But at the very least, they heard the backlash and maybe are reconsidering it.
No.
Yeah.
What happened was they were like, we can't give you any more taxpayer money until the next fiscal year. I just said fiscal wrong.
That's okay. That was better than you normally do, to be honest. But hey, isn't that progress with our public bodies?
I mean, I guess.
I mean, simply by delaying it a month and a half, they're putting more thought into it than our legislators did to give $750 million to the Raiders.
That's fair.
So progress.
What other tax-funded organization can give the Raiders money?
That's a good question. We need to look that up. We need to find every possible taxpayer-funded place that can just, here, Raiders, we want to be the official blank of the Raiders.
The Toronto Maple Leafs have the highest cap hit in the NHL.
That is partially to them loading up with five players on long-term IR, like they traded for David Clarkson from Vegas. But last night...
We could use David Clarkson.
We could. Last night was a battle of two of the more disappointing teams in the NHL this year. Despite the high payrolls, Vegas went into that game with the 20th best record in hockey, the Maple Leafs 21st. The two teams have combined to win 20 games and lose 26 games. So those are two of the more disappointing teams this year. The Maple Leafs are an interesting team in that they're second in the league in Corsi, but 24th in expected goals percentage. They take the most total shots per 60 minutes, but they're bottom half of the league in high danger chances per 60 minutes. So they are all about quantity and not quality. Which seems weird, by the way, given that they've put so much money into their forward group. Like, for example, last year, San Jose was a team that Corsi, like, they just shot from everywhere, specifically from deep from the blue line. But that made sense because they have Brent Burns and Erik Karlsson. They've got a lot of money tied up in offensive-minded defensemen who are going to shoot from the blue line a lot. The Maple Leafs have all their money in the forwards, and they can't get into high-danger chances. Like, they can't get in the slot. They can't get in front of the goalie. So it's just very strange with Toronto, and Mike Babcock might get fired.
Is it Jovan Mooring levels of heat check, or is it J.R. Smith levels of heat check whenever they're taking these shots?
Heat check would imply they've already scored.
Ah, okay.
And that's part of their problem, is they don't do a lot of that.
So, all right. So it's Nick Young.
Yes.
The Golden Knights have the fifth highest cost for a family of four to attend an NHL game.
$560 for four people. Story from lbsportsbiz.com. Do you want to guess the top four teams, by the way?
Oh, man. You always do this to me.
Yeah.
Hockey's weird.
Not as weird as you think for this answer.
The Rangers.
Yep. They're number one.
I want to go with Dallas.
No.
Okay. The Kings?
No.
Really? All right. Blackhawks?
Yes, number three.
The Canadiens?
No, although that one probably should be up there, but no, not the Canadiens.
I got nothing.
Toronto, number two, and the Boston Bruins are number four.
All right.
Stanley Cup champs in Boston.
Yeah.
What is interesting, though, to me at least, the Golden Knights have seemingly had a few more empty seats this year. Like, it's not a lot. It's not like, oh, there's nobody going to Golden Knights games. But it's certainly, it feels like, oh, this isn't quite a packed house every night. And I couldn't find it again, but someone had tweeted right before they played on Sunday against Calgary that they could get a ticket for less than $30. Now, granted, it was right before the game, so it was like, oh, crap, somebody really just wants to sell their ticket. But that is a change from what has been happening recently. My other question, though, is who's taking their whole family to Golden Knights games? You guys got to stop having kids. Why are you trying to take two kids to a hockey game?
I mean, don't stop having kids,
no,
everyone.
No, stop having kids.
No, don't stop having kids. I'm not saying have more kids. I'm saying just have kids in general.
No.
We need young people.
Yeah, we got plenty of them.
It feels like we've got too many old people.
Yeah, but
we need a counterbalance.
Having kids doesn't stop the old people from living.
When the war comes.
Trey Woodbury scored 17 points for Utah Valley against Kentucky on Tuesday.
The former Runnin' Rebel had a great game. He has 50 points in five games for Utah Valley. You want to guess how many he had all of last season for UNLV?
Is it 17?
30.
Yes. Okay.
So he's outscored his time at UNLV already at Utah Valley. What's actually funny, though, he is 6 of 21 from 3 at Utah Valley right now. It's only 29%. He was 6 of 21 from 3 at UNLV last season. Very small sample size, but it's not like he's actually improved his three-point shooting, which is what he's supposed to be good at. Also, Ben Coupette, averaging 15 points per game at Arkansas Little Rock. He has made 7 of 13 threes this season in his UNLV career, 0 of 15 on threes.
I forgot Ben Coupette existed.
Yeah, that's fair. So it is interesting because...
Is Louis Bongai somewhere?
That's a good one. I haven't actually looked that one up. What happened to Louis Bongai? I know Jonathan Chamuchachwa is sitting out this year at Baylor. Joel Tomboy, as far as I know, still hasn't been cleared or denied by the NCAA. That he's going to get like cleared with 6 games left or something.
Got to go on a great tournament run, yeah, and then get drafted.
So he's at Texas Tech but not playing. What happened to Tervell Back? He went to Cleveland State, but then Cleveland State fired their coach in like August. And I don't know if he stuck around or not. I'll have to go look up what happened to Tervell Back.
There's a joke I can't make.
But it's,
there's jokes, so many jokes I can't make.
Yeah, you can make them now. But it is interesting because you look at Coupette and you look at Trey Woodbury. These were players that were, for the most part, buried on the bench at UNLV. And they look like useful Division I players, especially when you compare. UNLV's 156 in KenPom right now. Little Rock is 159. Ben Coupette's currently their number 2 player. And Utah Valley is 177. So, like, these are teams that are sort of in a similar realm of where UNLV is right now. And they weren't used at all for UNLV. Like, Ben Coupette got very limited playing time last year. I will say, in defense of Marvin Menzies, and if you want to criticize Otzelberger for not keeping them, there was never a point where Ben Coupette did anything on the floor to suggest that he should keep playing. He played, was it the season opener last year that he played in, and was a train wreck on offense. Had no idea where to go. Was completely lost on where to go. Like, there was no reason to think Ben Coupette should have played more minutes. And Trey Woodbury last year was last on the team in 2-point percentage and 3-point percentage. Like, Trey Woodbury didn't do anything either to say, hey, you've got to put that kid in the game. But it's not the greatest look that they're having success early in the season at other places that aren't exactly terrible schools.
The Lady Rebels lost to Southern Utah in overtime.
An 0-3 start to the season. Losses to Cal State, Fullerton, Duke, and Southern Utah. Not great. But game against Southern Utah. UNLV went on a 22-5 run in the fourth quarter.
Dang!
To eliminate a 17-point deficit and force overtime. 22-5. We've thought this whole time that the Golden Knights were bad at holding late leads and that UNLV basketball was bad at holding late leads. Imagine blowing a 17-point lead in the final 10 minutes of a game.
Yeah.
Like, that is brutal. And on top of it, Southern Utah, after UNLV caps off this run to tie the game, 2 seconds left, Southern Utah gets free throws in a tie game, missed them both.
That's not clutch.
They did win in overtime, so it didn't ultimately hurt them at all. But, like, again, for all the blown leads we've seen in this city recently, Southern Utah's women's basketball team was like, ah, watch what we can do.
Man.
It's impressive. UNLV plays Texas State tonight. Fun fact, Texas State is ranked higher in KenPom than UNLV.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Tyler Bischoff is
the dumbest smart person I have ever met in my life.
Technically correct.
UNLV concludes to Texas State. Texas State's team was 24-10 last year, and they are ranked higher in KenPom than UNLV. Texas State is not Abilene Christian or even Purdue Fort Wayne. They're a very solid opponent with zero name power, which is the worst type of team that UNLV can play. Because if you lose this game, people are going to say, holy hell, you lost to Texas State. If you win the game, they're going to say, oh, good job.
Yeah, they're going to go, who'd you beat?
So, KenPom does have UNLV pegged for a 3-point win because Texas State's like 4 spots higher in KenPom. And Air Force did beat Texas State 78-71 earlier in this year. I hope this doesn't become a repetitive thing throughout the season, but I'm fearful that it will. I think this game simply comes down to UNLV finishing at the rim. Texas State's an interesting team so far this season. Their starters are 5'9", 6'3", 6'5", 6'8", 6'8". So they're very small at the point guard and shooting guard spots, and they won't play a guy taller than 6'8". So they're not exactly a tall team, but they're top 100 in shot blocking so far, and they're 60th best in opponent two-point percentage. So somehow they're still doing a good job of protecting the rim without having much size, and the best team they've played this year was Baylor, and they blocked 6 shots against Baylor. That's their season high. So the only good team they've played is the one where they blocked the most shots. So I can't really figure out if they're going to be protecting the rim at a high level against UNLV tonight, or if this is simply a short team that UNLV will still be able to finish over, because Baylor had a hard time doing it. The biggest positive for UNLV this season is simply the shots they take. They're almost exclusively layups and threes so far. Kansas State's really the only team that's forced UNLV into mid-range jumpers. So Otzelberger's system, his coaching, is working in that regard. It simply comes down to making those shots, making semi-contested layups. Purdue Fort Wayne, Abilene Christian, they were good at the rim. UCLA, Kansas State, they were not very good at the rim. I fully expect UNLV to be able to get in the lane, be able to get to the rim against Texas State and pretty much everyone, honestly. Like, I think even when they play in the Mountain West, like Utah State, if Nemish Keita comes back, is really the only team that I'm that worried about UNLV getting to the rim. And even then, they'll probably get to the rim. Nemish Keita will just swat every single shot into the first row. But like, I think they're going to be able to get to the rim against pretty much everyone they play. It's just going to be finishing, and it's going to come down to how good the other team is defensively, because UNLV ultimately is going to end up being a pretty average team when it comes to finishing. So it's not going to be, hey, this team can finish over anybody. It's going to be, hey, how good are you at blocking shots and forcing misses at the rim? Oh, not very good. All right, we're going to score with ease tonight. So I think that's going to be the key tonight, and I think it's going to be the key most nights, because they get good shots. Like, they're getting the shots they want for the most part. They're maybe more contested than you'd like, but they're getting the shots they want for the most part. It's just a matter of making them. And don't go 3 of 18 from three-point range like everybody not named Amori Hardy did on Monday night.
Hey, he was 3 for 3 at one point.
Yeah, 3 for 4 is what he finished. So he was good. Everybody else, eh, not so much. On the defensive end, what I'm curious to see is how Otzelberger, how aggressive he is with either doubling the post or simply sending help side defense in the paint. In general, doubling the post is a bad move. At, say, the NBA level, if you double the post, a good big man is going to be able to pass it out, and the NBA is full of good big men, and he's going to pass it out to somebody that can shoot threes because the NBA is full of guys that can shoot threes. So at the NBA level, it's very, very dumb to double the post. At the college level, it depends on who you're playing. So if you go back to Monday when they played Abilene Christian, T.J. Otzelberger doubled the post in the first half. And the reason being, Abilene Christian has a bunch of non-shooters on their team. Their point guard, 27% from three last year, has not hit a three this season. So what UNLV did was Elijah Mitre-Long, who was guarding him, basically played the Rondo defense against him, or what teams played against Rondo when Rondo was with the Celtics. You just back off and play in the lane. Like, you don't care. Doesn't matter.
Put it up.
Yeah. And he, I think he took one in the late in the second half. He wouldn't shoot in the first half because that's what they were doing. And they had another guy who actually went 3 of 4 in the first half from three-point range. That guy is a senior, had hit 17 threes in his career before that game. So, like, they had non-shooters on the floor, and Otzelberger's game plan was, all right, we don't need to guard these guys at the three-point line, so we're going to double the post and just leave them, because even if they pass it out, we're not really worried if that guy puts up a shot from three. So it was a decently sound strategy. UNLV didn't execute it that well, though. They messed up some of the double teams and some of the rotations after the double team gets beaten with the pass, and it led to a couple of breakdowns and some layups. So Otzelberger adjusted in the second half, and UNLV stopped really doubling the post. And he said he changed some of the matchups too, to get better one-on-one matchups on the defensive end. So despite, again, not being overly concerned with them hitting a bunch of threes, he still adjusted because his team wasn't really executing it that well. Tonight, Texas State does not shoot a lot of threes. They are 292 in three-point rate. They only have two players that have attempted more than 10 threes in their first five games. Their point guard shot 28% from three last year. Their backup point guard shot 22% from three last year. Their center does not shoot threes. They really only have two legitimate shooting threats on the roster. So, again, for Otzelberger, it kind of comes down to how worried are you that that team's going to make threes? And I don't think you should be that worried. So I think they'll be aggressive defending in the paint. I think they'll be aggressive either doubling the post or just simply sagging off of guys or just aggressively sending help side defense when the ball gets close to the paint. I assume they'll do that because their primary tenet on defense is to take away layups. They'd rather take away a layup than take away a three, especially when the other team is bad at shooting. So it's something you should take advantage of as a defense if the other team's personnel allows you to. If the other team's personnel says, hey, we're going to put two non-shooters on the floor at all times, well, you help off with those guys. That's what's been the problem for UNLV basketball the last 3 years, is they have non-shooters on the floor, or they just have guys that aren't on the three-point line. So, okay, we're going to help into the lane. It could become a problem this year for UNLV because Bryce Hamilton is 1-for-13 from three-point range this year. Like, at some point, teams might just decide, yeah, we're not going to guard that guy. He shot 29% last year. He's 1-for-13 this year. We're going to sag off for Bryce Hamilton. So it could become an issue for UNLV this year, too, if they don't have enough shooting.
Sorry, I just went into a rabbit hole looking for the player that led the Orlando Magic player that whenever Shaq would get double-teamed, he would just throw it to, and that guy would sink a wide-open three. It was Dennis Scott.
3D?
He led the league in 1996 in three-point percentage because he was just wide open.
He got the nickname 3D because Shaq got double-teamed.
Yep.
Shaq is like one of the few NBA post players you absolutely should double.
Yeah, just let you go shoot a three.
Yes,
that's fine.
Absolutely. One other thing on UNLV basketball. What should we do with Bryce Hamilton?
I have no idea.
Primarily on the offensive end. He is struggling on offense like he did last season. Last year, he had the second worst field goal percentage on two-pointers and three-pointers. Only Trey Woodbury was worse, and Trey Woodbury only played about half the season. So as far as like main rotational players, Woodbury was the worst from two-point percentage and three-point percentage last year. This season, small sample size, 40% on two-pointers, 8% on three-pointers. Also the worst on the team in both of those categories. Again, only five games in, so the numbers have regressed, but we'll see what happens the rest of the year. But the bigger problem is somehow he's taking more mid-range jumpers than he did last year.
Despite a quote from the preseason that was, yeah, coach keeps trying to explain this math to me, right?
No, it was, he's showing me the stats and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Like, stop.
Yes. Last season, 30% of his shots were mid-range jumpers. This season, 37% of his shots are mid-range jumpers. And he's only hitting 25% of them. Like, he's not hitting anywhere close to, he's got to double his field goal percentage from the mid-range to even approach the conversation of an efficient mid-range shooter. The problem for Hamilton is he's basically been the same player he was last season. He doesn't consistently get to the rim. His three-point shot is not good enough, and therefore he ends up pulling up for mid-range jumpers, where he's also not very good. So I don't know exactly. Oh, and one other problem with him. He has the highest usage rate on the team. If you're not familiar with what usage rate is, it just means when you're in the game, what percentage of offensive possessions end with you taking a shot, getting fouled, or having an assist, or having a turnover. So if you do one of those four things, you basically get counted as having a used possession. And he has the highest usage rate on the team. So when he's in the game, he's doing more than anybody else on the offensive end, which is not great because he's the least efficient. I mean, maybe Sheknadembele is less efficient, but he's the least efficient player on the team. So there's a lot. Here's the thing with Bryce Hamilton. He has to play. Like, you can't bench him. Otzelberger has to play one of Bryce Hamilton or Jonah Antonio. And usually he's going to have to play both. And as we've talked about so far, it looks like Jonah Antonio is either going to be 5 of 9 for 3 or 1 of 7 from 3. And he's 1 of 7 from 3. You don't want to play him. But Otzelberger's pretty much got to play one of those two. Usually he's going to have to use both of them significantly. So he's got to play. The number one thing you have to do is actually get him to stop taking mid-range jumpers, to actually get him to comprehend, hey, if you can't get to the rim, don't shoot unless the shot clock is like at 4, right? Like, that's what he's got to understand, and that's what he did it all last year, and he's doing it all again this year. And right now, when he's in the game and he gets the ball, it's all right, it's my time. It's go time here. So they've got to get that understood. The other part is they've got to get him to understand that he's not the number one option when he's on the floor. Amori Hardy, Donnie Tillman, Elijah Mitrulung, those are the top three offensive options for this team. He's probably always on the floor with at least one of those three, if not both or all three. So he's got to understand, hey, Amori Hardy's on the floor. I don't need to drive with 21 seconds left on the shot clock and force up a floater from 12 feet away with two guys trying to block my shot. And that's something that he did a lot last year. That's something he's still doing this season. He's probably the one player that has shown the least amount of change in his game from the Menzies era to the Otzelberger era. Like, Hardy hasn't really changed a whole lot. He's just, there's less people in the lane to stop him, so he's benefiting. But, like, Mbaki Zhang hasn't attempted
a shot.
Dribble
around trees.
Yeah, Mbaki Zhang hasn't attempted a shot outside the paint yet. Nick Blair has, like, he hasn't shot at all. Like, he's just become role player big man. Like, I'm going to come set screens, come rebound. That's what I'm here to do.
He's going to fight for that ball.
Yeah, like, that's what his job is at the moment. So, like, but Scrappy. Bryce Hamilton is the same guy. So they need him, but they got to rein him in. They got to rein him in and get this whole math through his head, the stats and stuff through his head that, yeah, mid-range jumpers, not good.
In, hypothetically, Marvin Coleman doesn't ever take a mid-range jumper or a three-pointer or get to the rim, but anytime he gets the ball, he passes it to someone else. Is he more valuable?
Probably not, because Hamilton has been decent on defense. That's the one saving grace for Hamilton right now, is he's been better defensively than Jonah Antonio. And that's part of the reason why we've seen Antonio bench in a couple of games is defensively, and it's usually Hamilton that's eating up the rest of his minutes. So I would still say you'd rather stick Hamilton in there simply because defensively he's, I assume, giving you more than Marvin Coleman, just because he's like 6 inches taller than Marvin Coleman and a lot bigger. So Hamilton, he's been pretty good on the defensive end. That is something that we probably should point out, too, that he's been solid down there. It's just a matter of him sort of ruining possessions frequently on the offensive end that's become a problem. So, no, I wouldn't think Marvin Coleman or Jake Green's a better option. And the other thing with Hamilton is he got limited playing time last year. Like, he wasn't playing a ton. He was a part of the rotation, but wasn't playing a ton. And this year, it's only 5 games. Kid was a 4-star recruit. It's probably in your best interest to wait it out with him. I doubt there's going to be significant change to where he's like, oh, wow, this guy's really good. But, like, if you can get him to start fitting in more with the offense or taking the right shots, then you could see some improvement. You see flashes with him. Like, that's the thing. Like, there are times in the half court where he makes a move and you're like, damn, he's got the best handles on the team, or in transition every day. He hasn't done a lot this year because they haven't really run very much this year. Don't tell anybody that. They're not doing much running. So he hasn't got a chance. But he's probably their best player in transition.
They're the screening rebels.
They are the screening rebels. He's probably their best player in transition. So there are flashes. So you're certainly sort of holding on to the hope that he becomes something, even if he hasn't shown it yet.
All right. Before we move on, and I want your score prediction. I have a stat. UNLV is 0-2 when they play against Bears. They're 1-0 against Mastodons, and they're 1-1 against Cats. Oh, and they're 2-0 against church schools.
Texas State is the Bobcats?
Yes.
So they were 1-1 against Cats? Is that what you said?
Yes. Wildcats, to be specific.
Interesting. So now they've played two wild. Is there a difference in a Wildcat and a Bobcat?
Actually, if you've ever Googled a picture of a Wildcat, it looks very, very, very similar to what if a house cat had gone feral.
I don't know what a wild cat looks like.
No, I'm telling you, it looks like a house cat that has gone feral. Like,
so looks like small.
Yeah, just looks like a cat.
Okay, I don't know. Is a wild cat an actual animal?
Yeah,
just seems like a weird adjective you threw on the front of cat to get there.
Well, like Bob.
Well, Bob's not an adjective. That's just the cat's name. 7167. Hunter Renfrow is the perfect slot receiver.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler.
A very big sports story is happening.
Tyler Bischoff is...
If a very big sports story was happening, we'd know it.
We do know it. We just don't understand it.
You don't understand it.
Technically correct.
Hunter Renfrow might be the perfect definition of a slot wide receiver. He is the perfect definition of a role player in this Raiders offense. They brought him in as a slot receiver from Clemson and basically just plugged him into that same exact role with the Raiders, and it's like nothing's ever changed for Hunter Renfrow. The negative side of that, he has just three receptions that have gone for 20 yards or more this year. One was a 67-yard touchdown, another one for 27, and then one for 20. Obviously, you would like it if guys broke off more big plays, but that's not who Hunter Renfrow is. Two stats from Hunter Renfrow that sort of signify how good he is at his role. He's been targeted on third down 21 times this year. He's converted the first down 12 times. That's 57%, which might not sound extremely high, but the NFL leader as a team in third down conversion rate is Dallas at 52%. So Hunter Renfrow being targeted in the passing game is more efficient on third down than any team in the NFL is overall. The other stat is that he catches the ball 5.5 yards down the field on average. He picks up 5.6 yards down the field after the catch on average. Again, you would like big catch and run numbers, but what that number means in this offense is Derek Carr has a short, safe, quick option to get the ball out. And you pretty much know, hey, we're going to throw it to him 5 yards down the field. He's going to catch it, and he's going to get six more. And what that means is, oh, it's second and eight. It's third and four. It's first and 10. Hunter Renfrow is going to get a first down, and all we have to do is ask Derek Carr to throw the ball 5 yards down the field, roughly a second after he catches the snap. Like, that's it couldn't be, like, the only way it's more perfect for this offense is if Hunter Renfrow would break tackles and go score a touchdown every time. Like, that's the only way it could be better, but he's perfect for what the Raiders want the offense to be and what Derek Carr is looking for in the passing game, or I should say maybe what John Gruden is looking for in the passing game, because that's what John Gruden designs, is short passing games. Every receiver except Tyrell Williams, their average depth of catch is like 6 yards. So, like, that's what they're, like, even Darren Waller, I'm like, that's the guy who makes big plays. He's got, like, the same depth of catch as Hunter Renfrow. I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. What's happening here? So, like, obviously, Renfrow's not a great option if it's third and 17, but the Raiders don't face a lot of third and 17s. The Raiders face a lot of third and sixes or a lot of third and threes, and that's where he's terrific. Renfrow is absolutely perfect for that type of setup. So he's been, like, I wouldn't say Hunter Renfrow's been like a, it's hard to say he's been like a breakout star, but he's literally been like exactly what you thought he was going to be. Maybe a little bit better, a little bit more consistent than you thought, but he's pretty much been exactly what he was at Clemson. Hey, let's put him in, and he's going to be the same exact thing here. There is one issue with it, and that's maybe it's becoming predictable because he's been the number one target on third downs. Derek Carr's pick against the Bengals, it was third and four. He was looking for Hunter Renfrow on a short route, and the safety for the Bengals basically abandoned, I think he was supposed to be in cover three and be the deep third, basically abandoned the deep third to jump Hunter Renfrow 4 yards down the field and picked it off. Like, it was, it didn't matter. Like, Derek Carr was, it was almost like Derek Carr was pre-programmed to throw to Hunter Renfrow on third down, and the safety knew it. So just get, like, I think it was Darren Waller was running down the middle of the field, probably would have been wide open for like a 40-yard touchdown had Derek Carr seen that. So maybe a little predictable, but Hunter Renfrow, been good.
I swear to God, I'm breaking your glasses.